At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
All right. Hello, everybody. Thank you, JC, our local libertarian podcaster main support here. Welcome back, everybody, to In Liberty and Health. Hopefully you enjoyed yesterday's show that kind of came together last minute, but I still think it was a good show. World War III, is it going on? Is it going to happen? We'll discuss today, amongst many other things. But I don't want to keep you guys too long in this portion of the show because I do have two videos I want to play real quick before I introduce my guest. So make sure you hit all the links below where you can find my guest who's been on the show plenty of times. Just looked, I think this is his 5th or 6th appearance and 3rd appearance by himself. Maybe I'm wrong. I think that's what it was. Anyways, links below where you can find my guest, everything I got going on, Fox & Sons Coffee and Tiger Fitness. Make sure you go there to get all your supplements. I just placed an order and got a whole ton of stuff. So, yeah, guys, let's rock and roll.
What is up, everybody? My name is Kyle Matovic. I am the host of the In Liberty and Health podcast, where we talk all things liberty, health and wellness, and beyond. My hope is to encourage and spread the message of liberty and physical and mental well-being. I hope you enjoy all the topics we talk about with our guests. We're on all major streaming platforms, so please sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Man, I'm doing as good as anyone can do getting buried by his 13-year-old son on leg day.
I'm not going to apologize for not being on this podcast because I got to go see Metallica. So if that's a problem, kiss my ass.
Okay. Oh, yeah. All right. It's just that the idea that we share any kind of values with Israel, certainly what maybe America does now in its modern iteration, and if you just look at our Congress, the most immoral and evil people in our society, but certainly the American people don't see themselves that way. I think I've said before that I think that the last vestiges of American exceptionalism in many ways burned up with Aaron Bushnell outside the Israeli embassy in D.C. this year. But I mean, the American people did not know, generally speaking, what Israel was capable of. And
there it is. Connor Freeman, welcome back, brother.
Oh, man. Thank you. I'm glad to be back. I like that guy. He dresses just like me.
Yeah, you know what's funny is I had to watch quite a few of the judges shows, and I've tried to catch every single one of your appearances on there, and I think I have. But I remember when you pointed out that you said that clip that I just played. I'm like, oh my god, you know what? That really hits the nail on the head. Like, I think there is a large faction of the political right and an even larger faction of the political left that's kind of like, what are we doing here? Like, before, most people are like, yeah, whatever, Israel's cool, we already fund them, whatever. But I think at this point they've kind of seen what's been going on over the last, you know, 6 months, and just like, dude, this is absolute fucking insanity. And then when you just have like the blatant disrespect that the Israeli government feels for the U.S. people, just it's so beyond amazing to me how people can still support this.
Yeah, it's been there the whole time. And it's just, you know, the Hamas attack on October 7th has caused more changes in the American political scene and than I could have ever expected. I mean, I still don't think we totally understand exactly what's happen and what the ultimate ramifications will be, whether we're talking about for the anti-war movement or for libertarians or for conservatives or leftists. I think, you know, it hasn't had the impact that 9/11 did. Mm-hmm. And it's not just because it didn't happen to us and it happened to the Israelis. It's it's because the Israeli campaign has been this nonstop deluge of just atrocities, and it is genocide. But I mean, even before it was clearly a genocide, we were already seeing video after video every single day on Twitter of hundreds of people dying And a lot of it was children and women. And you know, some people have said it's like the Nakba in color. You're seeing all these people being displaced. They've displaced well more than they did in the original Nakba. We're up to something like 1.7, 1.8 million Palestinians. It's about 90% of the population. So it's probably more than that, actually. But it's visually been such a visceral nightmare, not just for the region and for the Palestinians, but for the American people. It's been an incredible wake-up call in a way that, you know, there just wasn't that kind of footage, that volume of footage anyway, available for during the dirty war in Syria or the war, the regime change in Libya or the, even the Iraq war. I mean, the collateral murder video that was leaked by WikiLeaks and Julian Assange had a major impact, I think, on certainly myself and, you know, the anti-war movement and a lot of libertarians. But in this case, I don't think the American people had ever been confronted with what Israel is truly capable of, and what our government is capable of being complicit, what kind of atrocities and war crimes and mass murder our government would happily facilitate and underwrite and support and aid. And so it's a mask off moment for pretty much our entire political system and our ruling class. And I'm excited to talk to you about it because we always have great conversations, man. And I was thinking about this stuff last night. I put out a tweet about it today because on the one hand, I was thinking about what we were going to discuss last night. And I realized I've never been more ashamed of my country. But at the same, just because the Israelis are literally dragging our entire society through the mud, right, and making us a party to the worst kinds of, you know, crimes against humanity that I've ever witnessed. And I think that's true for a lot of people. But I do think that things are changing, and it's in the polls too. And you can see it on social media, and it does feel like there's a shift on the right. You're probably more tapped into that than I am. I get stuck in kind of an echo chamber when it comes to, cause I only have Twitter and most of the people I follow are anti-war. So sometimes when I talk to people, they'll remind me like, cause I'll be like, you know, things are really changing. They're like, no, they're not. And I'm like, oh, well maybe they're not, but I kind of need to believe it.
No, I completely get it. One kind of chink in the armor for me, because I'm like, man, I don't think the right wing's going to like complete. Like, I think they're just going to go along with Israel as far as they go. But there was a little bit of a real white pill for me, if you will. My one tool guy comes in and he's just kind of like, you know, he lives out, I want to say probably like 15 minutes away from me. He lives pretty damn close. And, you know, your standard kind of blue collar tool salesman, just all around good dude. I shoot the shit with him all the time. You know, his wife is a real estate person who like travels down to Florida. They're just like regular old people. And I remember him saying like, man, there can't be anything left of Palestine there. Like, Jesus Christ. And he also mentioned, you know, at one point before, like, oh, you know, gas prices are so much cheaper before this guy got in the White House. And like, when he said that about like, oh my God, there can't be anything left of Palestine, then I was like, oh, he's seeing it too. And I think a lot of people are of the mind like, yeah, we like Israel and we don't like those damn Palestinian terrorists. But I think a lot of people are kind of like, I don't want to fund this anymore. Like, dude, our infrastructure is falling apart here. The border situation is an absolute disaster. And like, we're still sending billions of dollars over there. Now, the flip side of that is that you see somebody like Matt Gaetz, who I think you and I would both agree is just absolutely heroic when it comes to stuff in the Middle East. Until you get to Israel.
Sans Israel, and, yeah.
Oh my God, dude. It's infuriating because he's spot on with all the Ukraine stuff, but then like, I can't help but just feel like I'm getting played when I look at them saying, not a single penny more for Ukraine, but then they'll never touch Israel. They will not say a word. And in fact, Matt Gaetz will be like, oh yeah, Israel just got attacked, but we're funding all this stuff in Ukraine. Like, should we just not fund either? Like, isn't that the right position?
Yeah. It looks to me like Israel got themselves into this mess. Right. You know, I want no part of it. And I'm starting to become a little bit more radicalized on the Israel thing just because I think that I would like to see BDS really catch on with the American people. I would like to see it blow up. And I'm not advocating sanctions because, you know, libertarian, it's against libertarianism. But I I wouldn't oppose it, to be perfectly honest with you, if people were advocating that. Because we shouldn't have anything to do with that society, to be perfectly honest with you. I think that we should boycott it. We should be, you know, encouraging companies to divest. It's just, this is, and it's really, I don't know how you repair that, because it's a completely psychotic, deranged, genocidal lunatic society. And so we have to be, you know, get away from it. And in the meantime, like you're saying, you know, Gates, you and I were singing his praises when we were bashing Robert F. Well, we were I think that that was the show we were talking about. I think we were still optimistic about Kennedy.
You know what's funny is, I think it was the last time it was just you and I, we were like, oh my God, RFK is going to be so awesome. He's good on China. And like, this is, I didn't know that he was like a fervent to his core Zionist. And this is before October 7th. And then like literally a week after, he got called like an anti-Semite or something like that. I want to say it was literally like the day I dropped that show. He got called an anti-Semite and then just went all in on Israel. And I'm like, dude, what the hell is going on here? Another thing that I just remembered though, when you were talking, when you said how we should have nothing to do with the Israeli society. My dad is like a big Trump supporter, although like he doesn't like talk about politics very much. And I hope he's listening. But like, I remember he said in a comment once when I was just talking about Israel on a stream, and he was like, you know, they sent over Israeli students to learn how to fix cars at one of his schools. And he was like, they did not share our values at all. And I'm like, that is so interesting to me, because like you kind of said earlier in the clip, like Israeli society is not like our society. I mean, that is like a socialist ethno state where they don't value other people's individuals if they're not Jewish. It, you know, and I know this shit sounds crazy, but like that Israeli society, they look at us like lower than fucking dirt. They really do think they're like the cream of the crop. They, because it is a religious thing. And I mean, even beyond that, like even the secular Jewish people, from my understanding, is that like they have this arrogant attitude. This is to say all of them, but like generally Israeli society does kind of look at the rest of the world as like lower than dirt. But then like, look at how they treat other people, specifically Palestinians or even like Christians. They spit on Christians.
Yeah, exactly. And Ben-Gvir essentially said that's a national pastime. That's a tradition. That's what we do. You know, that's one of the things, you know, there was a lot of reporting coming out of Middle East Eye and other outlets that hit me to the fact that the attacks on Christians got much worse when Netanyahu came back to power in December of 2022, which I thought was a very interesting angle and should have been. You know, I was talking about it on Conflicts of Interest, and I believe we were running some stories about it at antiwar.com as well. And I included it. I mean, I don't think I wrote up stories about it, but it definitely was including it in various articles and like adding the links. But that's another aspect of it too, because people forget that we've seen churches bombed in Gaza. We've seen people sniped and killed at Catholic churches in Gaza by the IDF. Mm-hmm. And even the Pope condemned that. We've seen, you know, they've just economically devastated Bethlehem since October 7th. And it was already, you know, they were under the brutal Israeli occupation for longer than the Soviet Union ruled Eastern Europe. Excuse me. And so, and it was just there was no tourism this past Christmas. And there was a really sad article in Al Jazeera about a lot of shopkeepers who were just, you know, basically, you know, going broke because all their business is gone. And in the meantime, their people are being ethnically cleansed. Well, this stuff that's going on in the West Bank right now is being largely ignored. But we were just covering it on the show today, Kyle and I, but the pogroms and the ethnic cleansing that's going, they've already killed, it's something like the death toll is nearly 500 in the West Bank since October 7th. That's 120 children. Last year, UNICEF reported, that's the United Nations Children's Fund, that it was the deadliest year for children on record in the West Bank. And, you know, it wasn't long. It was the week after the 7th, that story where, I believe it was three Palestinian olive farmers who the settlers came along and just murdered them while they were working. And then they held a funeral the next day and the settlers showed up again and they just shot to death a father and a son during the funeral procession. And so when I say like that, society has nothing in common with us, if someone did that in our society, we would, they would be like, you know, Charles Manson or something.
Right.
They, it would be like, it but would not be
normal.
Celebrated.
Yeah. Yeah. Or for the IDF.
Normalized. Right.
Yeah.
And, oh yeah. And there was other thing. Cause, the judge had asked me in that, the first interview we did about, you know, what do you mean? Cause he said that Anya Parampil had said the same thing, that this has mask been a off. Mask off yes. moment. Yeah. And I just, as soon as he said that, the story that popped into my head was in the West Bank before the 7th last year. And the, it was one of the deadliest years on record already. They had already killed about 220 Palestinians, mostly in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, the rest of the West Bank. There was a smaller bombing campaign in Gaza back in May, and they bombed Lebanon during that as well. But they, and people can Google this. I'll send the article. I'll send the article and put it, we'll put it in the show notes. But they, the IDF shot a 2-year-old boy in the head in a car with his father. Mm-hmm. And then they made excuses for it. We thought there was a gun, da, 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 and the kid died. And he's a beautiful, cute little boy, with a very white, you know, very white skin, let's say. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people, like, just like I say with the Christian thing, it gets kind of missed just because of the way everything is framed for us. We're supposed to assume that the Israelis are a lot like us. They're a Western style democracy. They're mm-hmm. secular, or they have a large secular population. And they're, you know, they're not these backwards Muslims, you know, with all their crazy religious, dogma. And, and in the meantime, you see that they absolutely hate the Palestinians are Muslims and Christians. And, you know, any society that tolerates an occupation for that long, and this cycle of dispossession and murder and torture of children, which is, you know, Israel is infamous for, and we can see the stories coming out of the Israeli media about what they're doing to people they're rounding up in Gaza. It's shocking. I mean, rape, waterboarding and raping UN workers. That's not the biggest story in the world right now. It's like, in fact, you know, the State Department, the deputy spokesman, Vandet Patel, got confronted about that. He's one of these effeminate, they're all, for whatever reason, the Biden administration has all these effeminate State Department spokesmen. Yeah. So I think it was Ryan Grimm who was confronting him about that story. And it had been out for a week. Reuters broke it. And he just goes, "We haven't seen those reports. Like, we haven't," I'm like, "Yeah, you have." You know, it's like it's insulting, the arrogance and the cynicism. The same thing you're saying with the Israeli society. They think we're lower than dirt. I think the American people are also realizing that, you know what? So the State Department feels the same way, which makes sense because look who's running it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they just lie to us. They lie to our face. John Kirby, you know, they get more and more smug, too, as this goes on. The more and more the bodies pile up. And by the way, that number of, you know, 8,000 or 7,000 buried under rubble, presumed dead and missing, or missing and presumed dead, that number hasn't changed since November. Oh, I think the death toll is much larger than what we're seeing.
Okay, so yeah, you know what? I actually wanted to get into this. Because I know you and I were kind of shooting the message back and forth where our mutual friend Dave had went on and debated with that one blonde girl who I've seen her debate. She did a debate with some girl on sex work or something like that. And then I went to her Twitter. I'm like, holy hell, she is like a paid IDF spokesperson. And then she was saying, this is the thing you always hear from the pro-Israeli people, but those are Hamas numbers. And it's like, okay, well, you know what? I'll throw it over to you. What is the problem with people always saying, but those are Hamas numbers?
Because and there's been some, I know Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did a story on this. And I think Kyle ran it as like a spotlight earlier in the war. But, so people should look it up. It's basically that was never done. This whole Hamas run Gaza health ministry. That is a post October 7th propaganda tactic. And the reason being they had to, because they were doing Holocaust denial, you know, for at least a month or more into the war. Mm-hmm. And then I'll never forget when John Kirby came out and said, National Security Council spokesman came out and told the American people that Oh, thousands more civilians are going to die. Thousands of innocent people are going to die. In my lifetime, I don't remember a spokesman for the National Security Council or the White House to come out and say that. So that's when they stopped denying, because even Biden was doing that. Historically, those numbers that have come out of these previous bombing sprees in the Gaza concentration camp, whether you're talking about the 51-day war from 2014, Operation Protective Edge, or Operation Cast Lead in 2009. And I have some data I can pull up too if you want me to share it about the scale of destruction and death in those campaigns. But they never used to do, because historically the Gaza Health Ministry has put out those numbers, and then subsequently it's checked and analyzed after the fact by the UN, by the State Department, by all these, the Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, and the numbers always, I shouldn't say the State Department, but the UN and certainly these human rights orgs, and it's always consistent with what is found after the fact. And has a very good track record. And everybody essentially concedes now that those are undercounts. And that's been true for months. They gave up on that pretty quick once they realized that Israel was going full clip into genocide mode and doing their ethnic cleansing, which is becoming clearer and clearer all the time. They're taking 16% at least of the land right now in the Strip, which is only 25 miles by 5 miles, 25 miles long and 5 miles wide. But they're, creating a buffer zone. And so they're taking 16% of the territory, and then they're putting a road through the central Gaza to cut the north off from the south. And they're going to take about a kilometer east and west of that. So it's, and we constantly hear from Israeli officials, members of the Knesset, whether they're in Jewish power, Itamar Ben-Gvir's party, Dave DeCamp just wrote a great story for antiwar.com about how they're just saying on Israeli television that, we're going to start rebuilding the settlements. We're going to take all of Gaza. It might go in phases, but we'll do it. And we have to. There's no other option. And they keep saying it's going to be an indefinite. They don't use this exact term, but they're saying it's going to be an indefinite occupation, which right. It was already occupied territory. The biggest lie is that we gave them Gaza. They put it under blockade, took the settlers out, and the IDF, but they put it under a full air, land, and sea blockade, and they've been bombing it and starving those people ever since. What's interesting, too, when they pulled out of Gaza, Kyle told me he interviewed, I forget if it was an Israeli, I don't think he was a settler, but what he had told me, what Kyle had told me, and it was an old interview on Foreign Policy Focus, so it must be on the Institute, that the view for a lot of Israelis is that the withdrawal from Gaza was the second Holocaust. So you can imagine the bloodlust that has been building up in that society. These are the kinds of people who back in like 2014, they go to hilltops and they bring popcorn, they barbecue, and they watch the Israelis with American planes and American bombs just level, civilian infrastructure and residential areas and schools and factories and with our bombs, and they enjoy it. They watch it like we watch boxing or UFC or something, or a football game. Again, something we probably shouldn't be involved with, or a people we shouldn't be involved with.
Yeah, it's so crazy to think about. And, I want to say I've kind of taken a little bit of the Dave Smith line, not to throw it back to him again, but like, I do believe what's going on there is the definition of genocide. But yeah. Once again, just as well as I do, as soon as you say that to people, they're like, okay, well, what do you mean? I've heard this talking point and it just boggles my mind. They'll be like, oh yeah, well, from the early 2000s, the Palestinian population has only grown. It's like, are you fucking moron? If you listen and you talk about this honestly, we're talking about from October 7th till now.
Yeah.
Where they've killed literally, what is it, like 1% of the population or something like that?
And again, like I said, I don't know how much, it's something like that. It's pretty bad. I mean, we're talking 34,000. It's about 34,000 people now, over 20,000 women and children, but it's not even really just strictly the numbers. It's they're doing domicide, which is a form of it's your where you make the environment, the land completely uninhabitable. And then the genocide, if you just go through like the UN definition and the convention of genocide and you go through what the actual requirements are, it's really not in dispute. My problem with I think using the word genocide is warranted, and the people that do quibble over the definition they're just revealing themselves to be,
you're not going to convince them anyways. I think we might've covered this the last time you were on, but the genocide, according to the UN, is to constitute genocide. There must be proven intent on the part of perpetrators to physically destroy a national, ethnical, or racial or religious group. Cultural destruction does not suffice, nor does intention to simply disperse a group. You know what? They had to change that last part recently. They had to have, because I'm pretty sure that what like Adrian Zenz, a lot of these people were hanging their hat on with the Uyghur stuff, which we've talked about ad nauseum on this show, was that they're doing cultural genocide to the Uyghurs in the Xinjiang province. Well, it used to say cultural genocide was a thing. So I guarantee you this had to change recently, because they're saying cultural destruction does not suffice, nor does intention to simply disperse a group, because I'm sure they would probably say, oh, well, you know, if you're just displacing people in Gaza, then that doesn't qualify as a genocide. But you've officially made their living standards so awful that, like, now they're even our State Department said, like, it's possible that there's going to be famine. But then, you know, you have Lloyd Austin saying, oh, no, there's no evidence of genocide. And then, you know, to, you know, stick it into the craw of some of our libertarian friends, Javier Milei saying Israel's not committed a single excess. Like, give me a fucking break.
They just keep stacking up the W's. Here, let's see. I'm part Jewish, so it's a little bit shameful that the three Jewish world leaders are Zelensky, Netanyahu, and him. Not a great look. If you go to the UN Office of Genocide Prevention and Responsibility to Protect, Article 2 of the definition, in the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. A, killing members of the group. Check. B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Check. C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Check.
Check.
Imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. Check.
Check.
Forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. They've come up with a new term because this is happening now. It's I'm going to blank on the acronym. It's in an article on antiwar.com right now. This great one from Tom Dispatch. But here, let me find this.
Okay.
It's where a child is displaced and they're wounded and their whole family is dead.
Okay. Yeah. Well, while you're looking that up, yeah, it's so insane to me that, like, people will recognize, hey, they completely leveled Gaza. They basically turned it into a parking lot, as everybody said, the day October 7th happened. But it's not genocide when, like, under the definition, you've now displaced that entire population and basically you destroyed all the hospitals. So, I mean, that in effect basically makes it so you can't give birth. Like, what are you going to say? Oh, they have rubble to give birth on, so therefore it can't be genocide. Like, it's so semantic. And if you just objectively look at what the fuck's going on, it's like, all right, dude, you lose.
They're literally restricting maternity kits because they could fall into the hands of Hamas.
Right.
They're restricting anesthesia, cancer medication.
Yes.
And obviously of choking off the food. Women can't breastfeed their children. They can't feed them clean water. They can't drink clean water. There's stillbirths that are taking place. The infant mortality. There was a piece Dave has at antiwar.com about I think it was from the World Health Organization, maybe the stats that came out, but it's all about how infants that are just born, they die. Yeah. Many of them are dying just in the next day or that day of from starvation because they're born at such low birth weight. Mm-hmm. And there's thousands and thousands of pregnant women in Gaza. And obviously there's about Just a few of the most of the 36 hospitals are destroyed. 400 health facilities have been attacked. They killed 700 people or more in just those attacks. You got, I just wrote a piece about how 357 other humanitarian aid sites and convoys, which shared their location with the Israeli authorities, but were still hit. Just like Politico reported back in November that the U.S. was even sharing that information with the Israelis, but the Israelis kept bombing aid groups. The lies about UNRWA, the Palestinian aid agency that was set up after the Nakba.
Oh yeah, they kept saying that UNRWA. Yeah, they kept saying that UNRWA was working with Hamas or something like that. So therefore, pretty much anytime you hear like they were with Hamas or anything having to do with Hamas, basically someone's like trying to excuse the fact that they killed them. That like the IDF purposefully went out of their way to kill, you know, civilians. So like the latest thing, other than the Iran attack, which I want to get to here in a minute, was the World Kitchen aid workers, and that seemed to really turn like a lot of people to be like, wow, what the, you know, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah, this, so this was because Jose Andreas is this celebrity chef from Spain, very tied up with the State Department, very close with Tony Blinken. you know, right before the massacre took place, Max
cooks his kosher veal.
Yeah, Max Blumenthal and Wyatt Reed wrote up a piece about just how in bed he is with the international political establishment, particularly the State Department and Blinken, who he said it reminds him of Thomas Jefferson, and gave him a fluff interview. And they were brought in basically to replace UNRWA, but they couldn't replace UNRWA. UNRWA has the largest distribution network and infrastructure. They're the group that should be providing the aid, but they're being attacked by the Israelis. 177 of their workers have been killed. Like I said, 352 of those aid convoys or sites were that were attacked were UNRWA. Of course, the narrative that they were involved in October 7th, which turned out to be based on complete lies that were extracted through torture. So they brought in this very connected company to come in there, which they do a lot of good work. They really do. They're just, they play up with a lot of State Department propaganda, whether it's about like Russia or whatever. Even Israel in the beginning, he's turned on them now because of obviously what happened. But these people were traveling along a pre-approved route that they had already coordinated with the Israeli military. They had giant logos of the World Central Kitchen logo on top of their vehicles, and they were hit. The first vehicle was hit. The survivors got out of that car, went into another. Then that car was blown up. And this went on for a few kilometers, and another car was blown up with the remaining survivors. They killed every last one of them. They killed the entire team. And, and that bothered people. I think, I'm not sure, it's probably because it was a bunch of Western, citizens, because when they do kill Americans, it very rarely gets the American people or even the American press. I've never seen Stephen Colbert do a segment on Shireen Abu Akleh, who is the Al Jazeera reporter, an American citizen, Christian woman. They blew her face off deliberately. A sniper did, and outside the Jenin refugee camp back in May of 2022. And then the IDF attacked her funeral and went over when people were carrying her casket. Yeah. They start beating the shit out of people with batons. It's all on video to knock it on the ground. And credit to the Palestinians, that they never let it hit the ground, even though they were being viciously savaged by these psychotic occupation soldiers. And so that absolutely did cause a huge controversy. But of course it doesn't translate into any kind of effective change in policy from the Biden administration. In fact, even these pledges that were made, well, Netanyahu's word really means nothing, especially when he gives it to the president of the United States, right? Who's this real boss? So it's like the boss promising. I'll get to it. He said that they would open the Erez border crossing. They haven't done that. And he said that he would allow aid to be transferred, use the port of Ashdod as a hub for humanitarian aid. Hasn't happened. They claim they opened a border crossing elsewhere, but it's not clear where. They won't specify. So no one, and the UN is saying that there's not been any change. There's been no improvement in northern Gaza. And that's where the famine is, according to a State Department official, likely already taking place. And the and Samantha Power, the war criminal herself, actually said that as well. She said that it's very likely that famine is already ongoing in northern Gaza. She said the scale of hunger is unprecedented. And that's just, there's a, Kyle just wrote up a piece for the Institute about how people should look it up. It's about, the headline is something about, it's something like, experts say, death toll in Gaza likely to be 100,000 by August. And one of the things that they point out in there is that, the experts on famines and humanitarian disasters say that the daily caloric intake in Gaza is well below what the worst minimums were during the Somali famines of earlier, like during the Obama years when we were waging war on Somalia. But that was a not a man-made famine. This is, and hundreds of thousands of people died in Somalia. And now you've only got 2 million people. All the infrastructure has virtually been destroyed, and they're confined to Rafah, where it's used to be only 275,000 people there. Now it's 1.7 million and they got no medicine. They got no food. They got no water. And, you know, they're lucky if you get a, if 30 or 40 trucks making it through the Rafah crossing. And that's what they're going to hit next. They're going to do a, you know, the estimate they said is that it if everything stays the same right now, we're talking 100,000 people dead at least by August. But if they, invade Rafah, which they've, vowed they will, and the Biden administration has repeatedly made clear, despite their ostensible, you know, misgivings about the approach, they're saying it's going to be tens of thousands more than that. So, yeah, the people that are saying, "Oh, it's not genocide," or "I don't believe those numbers," you're party to, you know, Nazi level, Vietnam War level war atrocities right now. And it's not like Yemen where it kind of goes in the background and the American people don't know about it. Everybody's going to know about this. This is going to change everything. In fact, that's what, I hate to sound like Biden, but that's apparently what he told the special counsel, Robert Hur, the guy who interviewed him about the Afghanistan documents, et cetera, and said he's basically brain dead. He said on October 7th, Biden was telling him that, oh, wow, this is real thing. This is going to change everything. Whatever happens here, whatever happens next here is going to determine the future for the next 6 or 7 decades. And meanwhile, we've got, you know, they're using AI programs to slaughter tens of thousands of people. And so, I mean, people are already scared of AI. What if the machines, like, you know, to take over with the singularity and then they start killing us because, you know, that, okay. But what if the Israelis get a hold of it? And like, we already see what it looks like. Right. I mean, that's the most alarming thing to me, is we're looking at, you know, and then way the things that they call them, like, "Where's Daddy?"
Right.
Gospel.
Yeah, Where's Daddy? Yeah.
Very, I mean, everything about it from the top down is genocidal, from the rhetoric of all the officials, which, of course, South Africa laid out in their case to the International Court of Justice. You know, the fact that Netanyahu most famously cites the story of Amalek from the Old Testament. So you and I'm not a religious expert by any means, but the upshot is you kill the men, women, children, and the babies and the livestock, wipe everything out. Of course, Yoav Gallant announced on October 9th, these people are human animals. And we're talking about more than a million children. And out of a population of about 2.3 million, and we're cutting you off from your fuel, your food, your medicine, and your water.
Well, that's the funny part. What you brought up right there is that people always say, "But they voted for Hamas," which this is such an easy argument to start kind of tearing apart. Because, like, look, if you're an American saying, "But they voted for Hamas," just think about what that implies about your country. Like,
yeah, okay.
we can go there if you want, but like, that means that pretty much every single American deserves to die. I don't think that, But like, if you want to make that argument, then once again, that puts, you have way more fingers pointing back at you when you make that argument. So like, whenever I hear people like Tim Pool saying, oh, women are getting hit in New York by criminals and they voted for it, therefore they deserve it. This, it's the same fucking argument. It's like, you can't be held responsible for what your politicians do. Why don't we hold the bad actors accountable and hold our politicians accountable, not the fucking people. The people don't deserve it. The people of Gaza, yeah, did Hamas do some bad things? Yeah, but like, I'm not going to sit here and give the obligatory, I condemn Hamas and Hamas is so awful. No, look at what the fucking IDF has done for years, for decades. Those are the people that we should condemn first. And then, you know what? We could say, yeah, Hamas did some shit wrong. But you know what? We need to point a whole bunch more fingers at the IDF and say, look what they did to this fucking population of people, where they felt it was necessary to go out and do an attack like October 7th, where, you know, we're still not even clear that the number was 1,400 people killed all by Hamas. Like, we are not clear on that at all. In fact, it looks like some of those people were probably and likely killed by the IDF. And yeah, we know, by the way, they treat their fucking hostages. They just fucking kill their own hostages. It's not even like they're concerned for their safety. People could keep saying, release the hostages. Tell Israel to quit killing them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, they admit in Haaretz, you know, the Israeli media is much more honest about this, the reality of all this,
right,
than our, certainly than our press, our mainstream press, or like Tim Pool or whoever. But by the way, I've seen it explained to him what the Abraham Accords was.
Oh,
how many times now?
God. Yeah.
Peace deals.
But, look, dude, I hate to say it, and I know I messaged to the guys and you earlier, but like, I can't help but believe he's legitimately being paid by the RNC, because every time this shit gets explained to him by people who are much, much, much smarter than him, in one ear, right out the other. And
yeah,
like, either you believe that these people are idiots, which I cannot believe that you would talk to Scott Horton and think this dude's a retard, or you're a legitimate bad actor who's being paid to not believe something. Your salary depends on you, and your interviews depend on you believing a narrative that Trump made peace around the world, because this is what people will tell you. I can't tell you how many Republicans would walk up to me and say, yeah, there was peace around the world before Biden got in. Like, you're not being serious, right? Because look at Yemen, look at Venezuela, look at fucking Cuba, look at Iran when we pulled out of the Iran deal and put on all of these sanctions, look at fucking, you know, all the deaths in Somalia. Trump ramped up a lot of these fucking theaters, and then he pulled it back, and then everybody said, oh my god, look, he's pulling out troops. Yeah, the troops that he put in, he's taking back out. It's political theater.
It was so cool the way he moved him out of Somalia to Kenya and Djibouti.
Yeah.
Briefly before Biden redeployed them. And that was heroic. Not that the war would stop, you know. He set records for bombs dropped in Afghanistan, yes, Somalia, correct, Yemen, hundreds of thousands of, well, by 2021, and look, he ran the Yemen war for 4 years. So do I know how many people he killed in total? No, but because Obama has that blood in his hands, and Biden obviously has that blood in his hands.
Absolutely.
But by the end of 2021, the UN was saying that 377,000 people had been killed. The vast majority of those were infants and children under 5 years old. And so the percentage was, and I forget the exact percentage, but I was just rereading, was about boning up on some of my Iran stuff. So I was checking some of the articles that I wrote, back in 22. And it reminded me that one of the things I had cited was that means that's 263,000 children.
Holy,
so
fuck,
that's what we were party to. But that's peace. And this is what I mean again about the, you know, Aaron Bushnell. That's the American exception. Because I think what he was showing, well, there's a lot of reasons people self-immolate. And I don't know exactly what was in his head. But what he did do was he showed, and it's pretty clear in his rhetoric before they killed himself. He was showing people what it looks like when you set a human being on fire, whether with a bomb or just dousing yourself in gas and flicking your Bic. But he was white, and he was an American, and he was in the Air Force. So when you watch him burn to death, it's kind of poetic. I mean, it does show the American people, like, this is what it looks like when it happens to one of us. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that to some degree, I mean, to a large degree,
And it, you know, because that's a key, you know, some who I would never join the military. And I used to have very little sympathy for people that joined the military. I was kind of an asshole about it. I was an evangelical anarcho-capitalist who thought I had, you know, real, you know, I read like whatever 15 Rothbard books or something, and was like, it wasn't that many, but and I was just like, yeah, you know, fuck you, you fucking parasite, psychotic little shit. You want to go kill brown people or whatever? You know, being an asshole, really, me. And he obviously, from what I know of him, thought he was doing the right thing. And a lot of these guys do. I was completely flipped on that attitude by a lot of these great whistleblowers and vets who have been on doing Scott's show for years, like heroes of mine, like Captain Matthew Ho and Danny Davis and guys like that. So. So I have a lot of humility about that. Wouldn't judge. And so, but that guy realized he was complicit in genocide. Speaking of that, I had an Uber driver who was a Republican who was bitching to me about the Biden State of the Union. And we were going back and forth and having a good time. And I think I mentioned something about Israel, or maybe he brought it up first. And then he told me, goes, yeah, my son can't, he won't join the military. We come from a military family, because I wasn't in, but my father, I forget what he says. He's like, my father was a Marine. My brother was in the Air Force and whatever. And my uncle was in the Navy. And he's like, my son wanted to, he's completely out of it now. He says, I can't even support my own country for the crimes they're committing in Gaza. And he goes, and I thought I always supported Israel. I did not know what they were all about. And that's just a regular guy, you know, a nice, very nice guy who's got all, you know, he's got other jobs. He's not focusing on politics, but it's getting to that popular. And this guy had maybe was in his 50s or late 40s. Nice guy. You know, you can imagine being kicked in the face with Israel and the reality of it. And so I think that's happening for a lot of people. I mean, it's very tough to wave the flag and believe in all the bullshit when you see what it really is. And that's the thing, we're talking about Yemen, and again with Trump, peace, he sets us on this path to brinksmanship with China and Russia, and you know, so the Abraham Accords, peace deals with the worst totalitarian dictatorships. Like, you want to go have fun, go move to Bahrain, see how fun that is. Just read the State Department human rights reports on Bahrain, one of our strategic partners. It's terrifying. It's absolute totalitarian despotism. And so, you know, they made peace. They sold us out. We would provide more arms on the backs of the American taxpayer, throw the Palestinians under the bus, build up a NATO style alliance against Iran, and make a bunch of money for the military industrial complex. And we do other favors for them, like recognizing Morocco's sovereignty over Western Sahara, another brutal occupation. And so, all we do is, again, for Israel, we drag ourselves through the mud, and Trump pulls.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
That's all the way. It's just, it's embarrassing.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. All right, so I got to get to these two comments because they're kind of related. Conor, I thought I saw from the Times of Israel that a father of a hostage or was thought killed on October 7th that he would have rather had that his daughter die than be rescued or captured.
Christ, I didn't see that.
And then the super chat from JC, thank you so much, brother, for the $9.99. Sorry if this was covered already, but is it true that over 50 survivors on October 7th were found to have committed suicide? I don't know.
I saw that on Twitter, but I didn't look for a link. I haven't checked into it yet. But if that's true, that's very interesting. Well, a lot of people were killed after the Kennedy assassination. Who were there ended up dying in all kinds of strange ways. I'm not saying that's what happened, but you know, it's not unprecedented if it's true, but I'm not saying that it is. I didn't see a link.
There's also the, you know, the whole Hannibal doctrine, right? Where basically, like, if they're prisoners, you just are captives, done, get rid of them. Like, don't never try to negotiate. And that's brutal. Like, your own people, you're willing to put down. Yeah, dude, it's awful. So I know you kind of want to keep this a little bit short, but the one thing that we have to touch on is Iran. So yeah. We've heard all our lives that Iran is 6 months away from a nuke, and I have my singer, my band, I love her dearly. She's just one of the most awesome people in the world. But I remember her and I were talking about this like right after October 7th, and I'm like, Iran doesn't have a nuke. And she's like, yeah, they do. They're definitely building one. I'm like, come on. Like, how long have you heard this? And this still has not come to fruition. Let's kind of go through the history and what led to
somebody showed an article from Bolton. I think it was from 20 years ago or something. It said like attack Iran before it's too late. Like this is what they do. It's shameless. So, this is some of the stuff that I got woken up to through Scott's show and antiwar.com. But the simplest way, I mean, you can read Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter and he's written a ton of articles that summarize it. And did a series of episodes with Scott as well, that people can check out on YouTube or at the Institute. But you don't even have to go through all that. A lot of it is to do with MEK forgeries of documents that the Israelis claim that they obtained in these like daring raids on warehouses where they break into a safe and look at this. But it's all the same shit from the Bush era. And all of it's wrong, where like the missiles are not what the Iranians really have. Like the models are all wrong. And one of the things... But even you don't even need to do that. The truth is, and this is what they never tell you on TV. I mean, it's so fucking simple. Iran has been a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty for more than half a century. They have a safeguards agreement with the IAEA, the UN nuclear watchdog. They've been verifiably not seeking nuclear weapons for more than half a century. Israel has somewhere between 80 and 300 nuclear weapons. They're the only country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons. They're the only country I'm worried about using nuclear weapons right now. And we amended foreign assistance laws, the astronaut John Glenn did when he was a senator in the 70s, that make all of our aid to Israel illegal. So the special relationship itself is illegal because they're a clandestine nuclear power. They're not signatories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So, and then, you know, the Iran thing, the both Ayatollahs have forbidden the production of nuclear weapons or chemical weapons. Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. Even when Saddam, with the backing of the West, was attacking them brutally with the worst chemical warfare since the First World War, they were not responding in kind. And again, Gareth Porter is the best on that and has great articles about it online. But the other thing too is, and people can just pay attention to like the last few years of Iran's expansion of its nuclear program.
Yeah, expand on like the last couple of years with Iran, because I think this kind of takes up to today. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so in 2018, after Obama enters the Iran deal, which is the way Trump characterizes the worst deal in history, we got all this nonsense. Obama was taking the potential for a war with Iran, which the Israelis have always wanted and the hardline neocons have always wanted, off the table, because we knew Iran wasn't making nukes, but now we doubled down and verified the whole damn thing. So this is the most comprehensive inspections regime ever implemented by the IAEA in history on any civilian nuclear energy program. In fact, Rafael Grossi just came out this week and said, we're always worried the Israelis are going to attack civilian nuclear infrastructure in Iran. I couldn't send my inspectors on Monday. Iran had them closed down on Sunday. They reopened them later on Monday, but we're going to wait until Tuesday because we know that Israel could do this. And they do routinely attack nuclear energy infrastructure there, which can cause huge environmental catastrophes. But nevertheless, so they were verified to be in complete compliance with the Iran deal the entire time. Obama, at the behest of Sheldon Adelson, rips it up Trump did in 2018.
Yeah.
And for a year, they didn't expand. The deal limited their uranium enrichment to 3.67%. Now you need 90% uranium for the minimum for weapons grade. And it takes, and Jason Ditz is the best on this in our movement, at antiwar.com. And he's an expert on nuclear energy. So I can't go through all of it, but it would take years for them to make a testable device and let alone to build an actual nuclear arsenal. It'd take longer than that. And everybody would know once they tested it. The whole thing is absurd, but they've only enriched to, so after a year of Trump having exited the deal and launched the maximum pressure campaign, they waited a year. The Europeans didn't back them up. They complied with the sanctions, which were illegal because they were in compliance with the deal. And they are entitled, I believe, in Articles 26 and 36 to walk back their commitments if the U.S. is, or if another party, the other parties are not in compliance with the deal. And they weren't because they reimposed sanctions. So they started inch by inch increasing their uranium enrichment. It got much higher. It went to 20% for the uranium tetrafluoride after they assassinated Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, one of their scientists. The Israelis did that using the MEK. Back in the end of 2020. And at that time, we wrote some articles and did some coverage about it at the Institute. I was very concerned that they were going to go to war with Iran in Trump's lame duck period. And then I realized that Biden was more hawkish on Iran than even Trump. So
everything, everywhere, yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the main thing if we can get right-wingers to figure out, you know. But they assume the world's in chaos because Biden's so weak, and it's the opposite. Mm-hmm. In April, when they expanded sanctions anyway, Biden did. And the first thing he did when he comes in office, he flies a B-52 over the Persian Gulf and basically saying, you know, giving them the finger and threatening them with destruction. So they announced that they're going to re-enter JCPOA negotiations in Vienna in April of 21. Israel attacks a cargo ship an Iranian cargo ship in the Red Sea. Okay. Then the talks begin, and Iran carries out a sabotage attack at the Natanz nuclear center. That's their centrifuge. The Natanz nuclear facility is their main center for building centrifuges. It's in Isfahan. It caused a major explosion and power outages. And so after that, that's when Israel ramped up their production, their stockpile of uranium hexafluoride, some uranium hexafluoride, to 60%. And so that's when everybody started to say, they're going for a bomb. And the Israelis always do that. But then even under Biden, Bill Burns would come out repeatedly, like once a year, and go, that's not true. They're not going for a bomb. And then it was confirmed in the Nuclear Posture Review and the National Defense Strategy and all this. Okay, so I don't remember exactly, because some of this blends into each other. Those indirect negotiations went on and on and on, and there was never any progress. I got pretty optimistic at some points, but it became clear and clear as we got into 2022 that they were not going to return to the deal.
As Biden said, the Iran deal is dead, but we can't say it's dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that.
Yeah. That is, he said that at a campaign, not a campaign rally. Oh, something like that for the midterms.
Yeah.
And, they pledged we'll never exceed 60%. And that might have been in 2021 or early 2022. That they haven't since. There's been no evidence that they have. And like I said, the IEA just came out and said that they're not expanding. And they did that to have leverage for their negotiations. And that's been admitted in this annual threat assessment that the intelligence community puts out from the DNI that just came out a month or two ago. And it's like the U.S. government knows the truth. They just are happy to lie about it or allow the legislators and the media to do it as much as possible. And the Israelis, they don't ever correct them. There's no threat. They do not have nuclear weapons. They have a civilian energy program, and they're perfectly allowed to under international law.
Right.
So.
Okay. Well, so now moving on to kind of what happened more recently. Obviously, we know that in 2020, late 2020, was December, right? Where it was like January 2021 when Trump had assassinated Qasem Soleimani, who was a very, very like esteemed cultural figure and general for the Iranian army. And also, as you kind of had laid out there a little bit earlier, that Israel has carried out assassinations on different like engineers and Iranian officials. And now, you know, they did this strike and they gave a lot of forewarning. It seems like Iran's military posture is always characterized by like great, great, great restraint. And I think that's because they realize if they get into the war or into a war with Israel, that means the West is coming with them. And that means, you know, they've been wanting this war for 20, 30 years. So what happened over the weekend? And do you think this is going to expand?
Quite potentially. It does appear. I don't think they always want. I think that there were hardline factions that wanted a war with Iran. But I think mostly they were happy to use Iran as a big fake boogeyman excuse to justify the special relationship with the U.S. And there's history about that that goes back to the beginning of the or the end of the Cold War, I should say. But long story short, because they used to be very close with Iran. In fact, Yitzhak Rabin, when he was defense minister in the late 80s, characterized Iran as Israel's best friend. They backed Iran against Saddam in the Iran-Iraq war. And they were buddies with them under the Ayatollah and under the Shah. What happened this weekend? Yeah. I think it's likely to expand because now they do want that war. I think that is likely a consensus among the war cabinet. They have to figure out how to balance it with their relationship with the United States. But I think they want the U.S. to fight Iran for them so they can finish their ethnic cleansing in Palestine. And they're probably, I don't know if they want to take on Hezbollah at the same time, but that'll happen anyway if America does go to war with Iran. Like you said, the Iranians are very restrained. There's been these protracted assassination campaigns and sabotage. There's drone strikes that, you know, get carried out in Iran, routinely against military sites and assassinations that are carried out against I wrote a piece about it called Biden Kills the Iran Deal While Israel Murders Iranians. I put all this stuff together in one spot. Iran virtually never responds. In fact, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal from 22 or 21, where they talk about more than a dozen Iranian oil tankers that were just bombed by the Israelis or sabotage attacked by the Israelis that were on their way to Syria, where the U.S. occupies a third of that territory and is stealing their oil while they're under crippling sanctions. And you have all these people living 90% living below the poverty line. You don't see that's why when this is the first time Iran did an actual attack on Israel from Iranian soil. The Israelis have carte blanche to commit all kinds of atrocities in Syria, Lebanon, attacking the Iranians, bombing Iraq. Nobody bats an eye. Israel has a right to defend itself, of course. Iran needed to demonstrate strength and reestablish some deterrence here, because Israel bombed Iranian soil directly when they hit the consulate in Damascus. They killed General Mohammad Reza Zahedi and his deputy and five other IRGC officers. And they had been killing IRGC officers in Syria this whole time. The reason this one was so provocative was because it was a direct attack on Iranian soil, this diplomatic facility. Under international law, that's what it is. And so they had to respond. They telegraphed it for 2 weeks. The Iranians, again, being very restrained, just like after the assassination of Soleimani, they give 72 hours notice. That gets passed, but to the Turks and the Iraq and the Saudis and the Jordanians, that gets passed to the Americans, of course, and then to the Israelis. So everybody got at least a three day notice.
You know what's funny is that we always hear about how, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's always funny when you hear people say, "Oh, the Israeli military is the most careful and precise military ever," and then you hear people say that Iran's going to go take on the world, but then they give a week's notice. Hey, guys, we're just letting you know, on a week at this specific time, we're going to start firing off some bombs. Just to let you guys know. Everybody clear? Everybody got that? All right, we're good. But Israel, Israel puts a leaflet on top of a hospital. They're like, all right, do we drop it? All right. Hey, go ahead. Right there. Let's go.
Yeah. What are you guys waiting for? Moral army in the world. They go, that's hilarious. I didn't even think of that. So they always go, who else drops leaflets and all this stuff? God, when you bomb a hospital, it's important to be polite about it. So they only attacked military sites. Those drones were meant to overwhelm the air defenses so that the missiles could get through. They hit two airfields and a military intelligence base and a military intelligence center. And they claimed that those were connected with the attack on the consulate in Damascus. Mm-hmm. Okay. One person was injured. It was a 7-year-old Bedouin girl who was hit by shrapnel from an intercepted missile, or maybe it was a drone. I think it was a missile. But again, no civilian casualties. When Israel did their bombing, they killed 16 people, including civilians. So, again, comparatively no blood drawn in this one. And it was calculated and calibrated to show Israel that, and they've made clear that if you escalate or retaliate against us, we will hit you immediately. It won't be this long grace period where we the drones take hours and hours to get there, and we immediately go to the UN and go, the matter is concluded. And again, they told the Americans, if you push for, you get a ceasefire in Gaza, or you push for one, use your leverage with the Israelis, we won't attack them. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the Americans didn't do that. And the other thing that they wanted was a condemnation, a statement from the UN Security Council. But the United States, France, and Britain refused. They vetoed it. And the it's amazing to watch, you know, this clip of Rishi Sunak getting into an argument with George Galloway about this. Because yeah. they just, you know, and David Cameron saying the same thing. It's kind of the consensus from the Americans, too, where it's just like, they clearly are. I'm not saying they're Jewish supremacists or they're certainly Zionists. They do believe that the Israelis are like us, just like us. They're very special. They're above international law. And that certainly that does not apply to us. This is the rules based international order. It's Tony Blinken's world, not ours. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so they so this is considered an attack, and it was framed as like this thing completely out of the blue. And what they keep harping on is they'll go, it was 300 projectiles that were launched. That's 300. They've dropped tens of thousands of bombs on Gaza. Right. And like, really, it's a silly thing to say, to focus on that. The Israelis apparently have postponed their invasion of Rafah because they were supposed to drop leaflets on Monday. They were going to let the people there know, we're coming in to kill you. So you probably should move out. We're getting ready to launch an offensive. Netanyahu was even giggling about that, about how, well, they could move back north. And then his people impression. On either side of him start laughing. Yeah. Thank you. You know, that's what he had said. And so then apparently Gantz on the war cabinet was in favor of a, you know, immediate response. But after Biden spoke with Netanyahu and told him, take the win and just let this one slide, which is essentially what Trump did after the bombing of the Al-Assad air base, after the assassination of Soleimani. So he's recommending that they go ahead and do that. And I don't know if the Israelis will, because they were hoping that there would be a massive retaliation that would justify U.S. intervention and a widening of the war for a lot of reasons, because that would distract from the genocide in Gaza, enable more ethnic cleansing. Then they can bring the Americans in to fight that war for them while they probably take more land in the West Bank. They already are. And then probably get some more U.S. assistance in fighting Hezbollah. And their little idea about building this anti-Iran NATO-style coalition did not come to fruition. Over the weekend, there's a great piece from Middle East Eye about this, about how the Mideast NATO project completely fell apart. There were jets, American jets, scrambled from the Al Udeid air base from Qatar. Also Saudi Arabia, but the Saudis, the Omanis, the Kuwaitis, and the Emiratis, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Emiratis, and the Kuwaitis made clear that they scrutinized their basing agreements and made sure that they did the absolute minimum and would not participate in any direct attacks against Iran under any circumstances if the U.S. felt they needed to retaliate for the attack on Israel. And the Jordanians even framed their interceptions here of just defending themselves rather than defending Israel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this regional coalition that I think it was Gallant who said, we're going to build up a regional coalition and then we're going to respond. And at a time and a place of our choosing, and it will be, you know, swift and all this, and decisive, but there is no regional. I mean, it's like, oh yeah, the regional, right? Like the US, Britain, France, and that's good to see. You know, big bad China thankfully made that peace deal with the Iranians and the Saudis back in March. I actually saw it was it wasn't Peggy Noonan. Who the hell was it? KT McFarland, maybe. It was some former Trump official who was on Fox Business who was going, China, they don't care about the Middle East per se. Yeah, they want peace and stability because.
It's just right there, like.
So they were talking about how, like, she was like, how the Chinese want, they don't want this. They don't want a wider war. And, I'm not convinced. I've heard some analysts suggest that Russia would step in if this war started with Iran.
Yeah.
If there was real a significant attack and assault against Iran, that they would step in. I'm not 100% sure of that.
Okay. You know what? I really wanted to get to this, and we could wrap on this too, but, what do you think the likelihood that Russia, China, or like any of the BRICS countries kind of step into this?
Because
I think that's where you're going.
Yeah. I really do think that, first of all, China would lose a lot of money just because they have hundreds of billions of dollars going into the Middle East and they trade with everybody. And the U.S. hates that. The U.S. is trying to separate them from China and from the Gulf states. And that's an ancillary of the Abraham Accords as well. It's one of the reasons why the UAE didn't get their F-35s, because they refused to cut ties with Huawei and other Chinese tech giants as part of the deal. I think the Chinese would be unwise to step in militarily, and I think the Russians would be too. Not just because of the risk of nuclear escalation, but if the Americans want to really, and they will do it. If the Israelis drag us into a war, there won't be a point where Biden or Trump says, no, Bibi, or even no, Gantz, or it's not going to happen. It's politically impossible. I'm really actually very concerned.
Or even that. RFK.
Yeah, no kidding. He might be worse, actually.
Yeah, honestly.
Even if he got on the phone with Netanyahu and he told him don't do it, Netanyahu has plausible deniability that he said something. I think it was, green light.
don't do it, BB.
Yeah, exactly.
Do it, Bobby? Do it? No.
And then Shmuley calls back to clarify. No, go ahead.
Smooly with the fucking nose and everything.
Oh God, it's amazing that he hitched his fucking wagon to that guy. China and Russia, if Syria comes under serious attack, which they already are, but I mean like bombing Damascus and trying to destroy the regime, I could see Russia intervening under those circumstances. But they've put up with a lot of Israeli bombings. We've been covering at antiwar.com and the Institute and Conflicts of Interest every week, basically for years and years. They've been bombing Syria. Russians never do anything about it.
Disabling their infrastructure too.
Yeah.
It's not like it's just like a couple people. I mean, airports, hospitals and stuff like it. I mean, now the Iranian consulate in Syria. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not like they're just kind of like, we'll just kill a few people here and there. Like they're really fucking them up, but
yeah, and if you kill a few people every week, that's a lot of people, especially if you're doing it for years.
Right.
But it wasn't like they sent like hundreds of projectiles. That would be different. That would be worse, even if they didn't kill anybody. Just the number is scary and stuff. So, but I think, China and Russia would be unwise to intervene because of the risk of nuclearization. Like I said, Russia may have to if there's a serious threat to Damascus and the actual Assad government. But I think China and Russia would be wise to sit back and let the United States completely destroy itself. Yeah. And that could very well happen because the destruction and the costs and the death of this and the economic ramifications of this war with Iran and the whole axis of resistance, which is what we're going to be fighting five countries at the same time, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, and the whole Palestinian resistance. So that would dwarf the terror wars. So we're talking more than 4.5 million people killed directly or indirectly. And it's going to cost the American people, you know, the terror wars is something like $8 or $9 trillion, I think, is the latest estimate from the Cost of War Project. But the other estimate is the interest. And as those rates go up over time, we're talking trillions and trillions more dollars. So imagine doubling or tripling that. The American people will finally get what bin Laden always wanted, which is a completely bankrupt United States that retreats in total defeat and leaves the region finally. And you know what? It's like Ron Paul used to say that the I don't think he's saying, and I'm paraphrasing, but I don't think that the empire will end one day because we convinced everybody of the principles of liberty and non-intervention. We'll come home because we're broke. That's probably what's going to happen, but a lot of people can die in the meantime. And I think I've been sort of pondering this lately, and I think it's because you look at the polling, the fact that 55% of the American people disapprove of the actually it's a solid majority. 55% are against any further military aid to Ukraine, but 67% of the American people want a ceasefire, including in Gaza, and including 56% of Republicans, 69% of Democrats, and like 78% of 69% of independents, 78% of Democrats. And then there's another number that's more than a majority, more than half, that disapprove of the Israeli actions and military actions in Gaza. So
yeah,
I think, you know, Rothbard used to say the key to the whole libertarian business is the war and peace issue. I think it's possible that breaking up the U.S. and Israel, which is going to be a long, hard fight, and I don't even know how you even begin to do that, but I think we're well on our way, at least to the beginning or the end of the beginning. And it's a long journey, but education is the most important thing. But breaking up the U.S. and Israel could be the key to the anti-war business, as if you want to put it under in those that terminology. I think that you know, because of the power of the neocons, if we do separate ourselves from Israel, there's a lot of problems that are no longer on our plate, especially in that region. And there's no reason we can't I wouldn't trust anybody in our government, but there's no reason we can't be like the Chinese and make peace between warring parties. Problem is, quite frankly, is Israel and their partisans and the neoconservatives and the liberal interventionists who are committed to unipolar global hegemony led by the Pentagon. And that's just that's what Biden's administration is. It's the logical extension of the Wolfowitz doctrine. And that's why they're headed for they're trying to bleed Russia as much as possible. And it's why we're on the brink of nuclear war for more than a year, 2 years now. And nobody seems to care because of the sunk cost fallacy. It's about politics, and we're, you know, they're getting ready to fucking fund another $61 billion here. It's going to be close to $200 billion because they just admitted last week that actually we've spent $14 billion on the war than we told you. And they're just trying to bleed Russia as much as possible before they go to war with China. And in the meantime, we're committing a genocide. We still have all these sanctions on the Venezuelans, and of course the Iranians and the Syrians. And the North Koreans, Biden has been much more hawkish on North Korea than Trump or Obama. Just the constant military exercises and sending in nuclear strategic assets is just, you know, raising the nuclear, raising nuclear tensions on the peninsula drastically. And it's all part of the Asia pivot. And so they don't care. There's no diplomacy with Kim, because why would you negotiate with Kim? Fuck him. He's small potatoes. We're going after Xi. We're going after Beijing. And so, it's just a horrible situation. But I do think that a major step could be taken if we could get the American people to demand. And I don't know if our government would ever respond to us, but it's going to be interesting, because I think we're not, I don't want to sound too optimistic and naive, but it could be years, but I could perceive maybe in the next 10 years, depending on how things go, that you could have a majority of a population that literally wants the American military and all of our and all of it, the empire's ants, all of our bases and special ops to just come home. We don't want to be an empire anymore, but I hope we can do it the easy way and not the hard way.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you, and it's really interesting. A friend, Don the Pleb, I'm sure you've probably seen him on Twitter. He's a really, really good dude. But he asked me, like, okay, well, what's the purpose of talking about, like, foreign policy? Like, they're just going to do whatever they're going to do. And I'm like, you know, it's actually really important right now, because I think, much to your point, that, like, if we can make the pro-Israel position so untenable that they decide, like, I can't run on supporting Israel anymore, that is the most important thing that any anti-interventionist can do. And before anybody that wants to jump down, or anybody wants to jump down my throat saying, oh, you just hate Jewish people, it has nothing to do with Jewish people. It has to do about a Zionist regime that's acting as a rogue state that we completely fund to the T, that is trying to drag us through the mud and bring us into all these different foreign conflicts. And I, once again, back to your point, I really do think maybe the next presidential election, the Israel situation may be something they're like, this could be political suicide with just how much Israel ripped the mask off of their own regime and has shown that, like, you know, U.S. politicians are just blindly supporting it. I think there's a large contingent in the United States with the polling data that you're bringing up that's just like, we don't want to do this anymore. Like, this is not our situation. And with how bad this looks, I don't want to be a part of this anymore.
Yeah, 50% of the people that voted for Biden at least believe he's complicit in genocide. And that's not insane. Nothing. Yeah. Right. And the fact that he's losing to Trump among Blacks, Hispanics, and young people, didn't think I'd see it. And I've spoken with at my day job with at least one good friend of mine is Mexican, who told me, he goes, I can't vote for Biden. And he is actually saying largely because of the border policy. but he also said he's committing genocide.
Yeah.
And he also said he thinks Trump is hilarious. Nice guy. Yeah. But that's good. I never thought I would have that conversation.
Right.
You know, it's and that's probably naive on my part. But the changes that are happening in the American political spectrum right now, I really don't think we totally understand. But, you know, even, oh, dude, I'm enjoying so much watching the crack up on the American right. The Candace Owens, Ben Shapiro thing kind of personifies it. Oh,
I am here for the bloodbath to the max, dude. Just fucking let these motherfuckers rip themselves apart. And, you know, I will at every opportunity call every single congressman, senator, influencer out when they talk about funding Ukraine. If Israel isn't in there too, I'm calling you out on that, because you know what? Now is the time to separate the wheat from the fucking chaff. Are you America first or are you Israel first? Because if you're talking about funding Israel, then you are Israel first. And I'm sorry, you are an enemy to the United States. As much as people want to fucking say that, oh, they're our greatest ally and this and that. No, at this point, when our country's in shambles and we're running headfirst into a potential war with Iran, you are my enemy if you want to keep saying that we have to fund Israel, and I will do everything I can to expose that to the world.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the role that they played in lying us into the Iraq war is unforgivable. And it's, you know, there's a
at the behest of Benjamin Netanyahu too.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, and the neocon fifth column, Richard Perle, David Wormser, Douglas Feith, you know, Paul Wolfowitz,
Frank Gaffney.
Yeah, get Cheney and Rumsfeld. This is some of these guys were acting directly on behalf of the Israelis. And you can go back to that clean break document. But also, of course, the PNAC cabal was largely made up of Israel firsters. But also the war in Syria was, you know, the main they played a huge role in it, the Israelis. And the Israelis took the side of Al-Qaeda in that war. It's called the policy was called Operation Good Neighbor, and they backed Al-Qaeda against Assad and his allies in Iran and Hezbollah. And again, I'm not a fan of any of these governments, but it's notable to the American people that it should be notable anyway that the axis of resistance, you know, yeah, they're led by big bad Iran, but do you know who their enemies are? Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Israel, and the US. Now, why would that be? Isn't that interesting?
Right.
You know, like, who, if we're really going to call someone the axis of evil, I think I found it. You know, like, that's yeah, it should piss people off. All of this. And, you know, like I said, it's morally devastating for us to be involved in any of this. You know, I mean, we're talking about
more than 1,000 children have had one or both legs amputated, and these are being conducted without anesthesia. The Israelis are going into hospitals and massacring doctors and nurses and patients, and then leaving their bodies in piles outside the hospitals after weeks-long sieges. And it's been normalized. It has been totally normalized. And that's what Bushnell was talking about. This is what our ruling class has decided will be normal. And so the American people have to just demand that, no, absolutely fucking not. And I think that... I think you're right that the Israel thing, you know, people can say all this stuff like, oh, they're pro Hamas, these demonstrators, these anti-war protesters, but everybody knows that's not true. And they're not anti-Semitic. A large number of these protests are directly organized by the most effective ones are organized by Jews, by Jewish Voice for Peace. And If Not Now, so give me a break. They're not anti-Semitic, right? I mean, and no one's like pro Hamas. I mean, yeah, they, when they say resistance is justified when people are occupied, that's international law. They're not saying like, yo, yeah, all the stuff that the Israelis made up about mass rape and beheading babies, we support that. Maybe somebody is. I imagine they also collected a fat check from the Israel lobby or somebody. Like if they said that, yeah. Right? But you know, by and large, it would be a negligible amount anyway, right? I mean, right. They had to make up those stories in the beginning. Oh, we heard somebody say gas the Jews at one of these protests. And then it just turns out that that was completely made up. Right. But Sean Hannity can just say it like it's a fact. And you have to sit there and just be like, oh, God, I'm sorry about that. I didn't realize, you know, we should probably just let this go without any protests. Like, it's not going to fly. The American people are absolutely furious about this. And I think they were primed for it by the outright robbery of the American people for the proxy war in Ukraine, which they could absolutely see the corruption. There's no way to hide it. And they can see how venal and how callous the American ruling class and our foreign policy experts and the blob are, that they would use Ukraine as a human battering ram and kill hundreds of thousands of people and put us in the direct line of nuclear fire from the Russians because of their crazy schemes for world domination. I mean, I don't think that's outside I think the American people can actually figure that out. Now, a lot of it's like, oh, they're laundering money or this, that, or Hunter Biden, they've got dirt on him. And I don't care. Whatever people oppose these wars for, that's fine with me. Right. But we're getting to the point where it's like a plurality. And Biden is such a horrible president and is so clearly asleep at the wheel or just completely evil. Like he's comatose, but he's also the most destructive, the most aggressive, the most antagonistic, even domestic on the domestic front, president we've had in even worse than under Trump or W. Bush in a lot of ways. And so people are just sick of him, but he's actually been a great boon for the anti-war movement and for just overall the anti-establishment movement. And I think we've talked about this before, but I have somewhat of a daydream that if Trump does get reelected, that he'll stab his supporters in the back the same way he did when he was in office. Only it could have a big impact. Like if you can even get less than half of the Trump supporters to feel like we always do and like the real leftists that we have an affinity for always do, that they don't have any representation in the system, then you have a very interesting situation because now they can be libertarians. They may go further right, but they won't be subservient to Trump or Con Inc. And Con Inc. has to just go.
Die.
Yeah, yeah. And whatever comes next, I'm not going to say it's going to be great, but this has to go. And I'm very excited about that. And again, it's like that once people realize it's not because Biden's weak that there's all this chaos. It's because he's doing the same thing Trump and Obama and Bush did. It's the same policies. They're working on the same. They have the same enemies and virtually the same policies. They just get worse and worse over time. The problem is Biden has been an absolute murderous scumbag, and so has most of his top officials, especially when it comes to foreign policy. Absolutely. I mean, Blinken himself is an architect of the Iraq war, the war in Libya, the war in Syria, the war in Yemen, the war in Ukraine, the war in Gaza. And so You know, I mean, these are just bloodthirsty sociopaths. And I think everybody can actually see that now. And they know how much disdain these people have for the average American, that they would just rob us blind and lie to us like we're too stupid to figure any of this out. And there's going to be hell to pay, certainly in this election cycle. But over time, I think it's going to be even bigger than that. You know, we can't really say what it's going to look like. But again, it's just like all this shit's instructive. Even Robert Kennedy's big betrayal of us.
Yes.
And Vivek, what a hawk he was on China, or his deference to the Israel lobby, too. Remember when he got up in front of the Republican Jewish Congress and he starts yelling, "I want to see heads on pikes."
On Jimmy Dore, him saying, he brought up the Uyghur stuff, and he also said, "Yeah, you know what? I'm running for the president of the United States, not the president of Israel." And he's showing him videos of whole hospitals and city blocks destroyed, and he just says, "Yeah, I'm running for the president of the United States." And you know what? Israel has the right to defend themselves. It's like, are you fucking serious?
Yeah. Oh God, it's so disheartening. And Trump did the same thing. You know, it's interesting when he says his problem seems to be that the IDF is posting videos of themselves committing war crimes. His issue is not the war crimes themselves. Yeah. He just thinks from a PR perspective, it's not a good look.
Look, I'm a master of marketing. You got to finish the job. You got to finish it fast, but you can't be posting it online. he gets it, man.
Oh, he does. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, wait a minute. Did you see that clip from over the weekend when he was at a rally and his own audience, MAGA hat wearing dudes, starts chanting "Genocide Joe"?
Yes.
Genocide Joe.
Beautiful.
Never thought I'd see it. And then he turns around and he goes, "You know, he could have corrected them, or he could have said something. Yep. It's not genocide." No. He said, "You're not wrong. You're not wrong."
Yeah, dude. It was a glorious video. I remember watching that. I'm like, he fucking knows how to play him, dude. Like, if people could say he's not a politician and he never was, listen, that dude is the best politician I've ever seen in my entire life, because he could play the fucking crowd. He could sell you a fucking car that doesn't run with no wheels and convince you that you're driving a fucking brand new C8 mid-engine Corvette. Like, he could seriously fucking do that, man, with the fucking charisma and just how he can fucking woo a crowd. It is impressive. Connor,
can you imagine how Kennedy would have responded to that? Israel is not an occupying power.
The Palestinians are the most pampered people on the planet.
They're raised to be serial killers. It's so embarrassing. God. And I went to Matt for that guy. We both did on the show. Did, yeah. I wrote that article for Ron Paul Institute. Oh God. And Dan is just furious with him. You know, he sounds worse than neocon sometimes, he said. And it's ridiculous, because I've never thrown him. I've never voted for president. I've never, you know, we talked about that. I was like, I may do it for this guy, because we didn't have anybody that was going to oppose that new Cold War with China. And they stabbed us all in the back with that shit and said that they're one organism with Iran, and Venezuela is a part of it too. And they're going to choke off all of our Middle Eastern oil, and Israel's our beachhead in the Middle East. And they're our greatest ally.
He'll talk about like peace and all this, and then he'll just randomly go, "But Israel is like a weapons ship in the Middle East." I'm like, all right, dude, come on.
It's unbelievable.
We're so close.
Yeah. Oh man. So disappointing. But again, even these big disappointing moments are very instructive for the American people. And that's what it takes, right? I mean, it's one of the things, like, we've been, like with Gates, man, we were so excited. He was doing great. Those bills he put for, those war powers resolutions to get the troops out of Somalia and Syria, and he had the squad working with him. They were getting, you know, it was like more than 100 votes, at least on both of them, on Syria and Somalia. And to see that coalition being built up was very exciting. And his positions on Ukraine were great. But the problem was that China thing. And I always figure it's that division of labor where they kind of take different spots, because the McCain thing, Hillary Clinton, that style of hawk doesn't really fly anymore. But it's all a learning curve, I guess. And so we've already been like, nobody's coming to save us. We're going to have to figure this out. And like, we don't have any representation. I think if everybody starts to feel that same way, then we can actually make some real headway. But it's, and I don't know. I mean, I wish I was more adept politically, but these, I think people just have to make their congressman terrified of losing power, right? You know what I mean, that might be the only way to do this. I mean, I don't know how else. That's the only thing they care about. But if you have a majority of the population says, like you said, that this Israel thing, if I support them, it's suicide. They're gonna have to choose AIPAC or your constituents. It really has to be like that. And so hopefully we get there.
Yeah, dude, I think that's the only way forward, and we may see it. Carter, this was awesome, man. I know you said you wanted to keep it to an hour, but I enjoyed talking to you so much. And, you know, hopefully we get to hang out at the Ron Paul event coming up. That's going to be in D.C. and I think over Labor Day weekend, because I'm definitely planning on going. I have to get to at least one event where I get to meet the people that I've had on the podcast who I haven't met before, because, you know, I've been doing this now for 2.5 years. And there's so many people I still have yet to meet. And it's cool to just get to talk to you guys and hang out with you guys, whether it be through here and hopefully in person one day. So, Connor, as always, always a pleasure. Let everybody know where they can find you, support you, all that good stuff.
Well, likewise, man. Thank you very much for having me back on. And yeah, please check out the Libertarian Institute and Conflicts of Interest. We're on YouTube, Odyssey, Rumble, all the, you know, all the video sites and all your podcast apps. And then we'll find my articles at antiwar.com and the Institute. And yeah, follow me on Twitter at Freeman's Mind 96, and then Conflicts of Interest is at con_interest, I believe.
Absolutely. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, take care.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.